नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि. So today, on this Magapuja, so I thought it would be nice just to kind of give a reflection regarding what it all means. And just encourage people just to put forth a little bit more effort, just to, kind of out of faith, out of devotion to Buddha, different monks and nuns, different teachers you've had, just to reflect on their practice, that we hope to gain some inspiration, some energy, and stretch ourselves just a little bit. And as you often hear me say, the practice is kind of a bit of a balance between putting forth effort, but also, you know, having this long-term perspective of it's not a sprint, it's not 100 meters, it's, you know, a marathon. So you have to learn to pace yourself and find some enjoyment and happiness in the practice. So normally in Thailand, on these nights, you have lots of lay people going to the monastery. There's usually a circumambulation, offering of lights and candle, traditional lights and candle, to the Buddha. Yeah, so they circumambulate the sala, the chedi or something. Yeah, and then most likely stay up the whole night. Here in the West, Maga Puja is not so popular. Not a lot of people go. But I thought even with just a few people in the monastery, we can still bring forth them a little bit more effort. We can still put forth a bit of practice out of dedication, out of faith in the Buddha, you know, the past teachers, as a dedication to Ajahn Chah, who we follow after his teachings. And it varies. You should probably know the practice on these kind of all-night vigil, we call it sometimes, the one extreme is, you sit perfectly still in the samadhi the whole night until dawn. And the other extreme is, you vary between sitting and walking. And as long as you keep refrain from the one posture of lying down. So even if you are sleeping or resting, you can do that sitting up, leaning against the wall or something, hopefully not snoring too much. But also, see what happens. Some people, you know, get good results when they stay up. Other people find that it takes them a whole week just to kind of get their sleeping pattern back to normal. So then obviously this practice is not so helpful. Anyway, like I said, it's an encouragement, not a requirement. So we can allow people here to experiment with your different level of comfort, where you experiment, where you're, how much effort you want to put forth without creating a lot of suffering and a lot of anxiety, a lot of negativity in the mind. So it is also just the process of watching the mind as you're sitting. Like, you know, like I said, I'm just asking you to sit. I'm not asking you to, not pulling your nails out, not pulling your teeth out. I'm not asking you to dig holes. I'm not asking you to do anything. So generally, it shouldn't be too difficult. But a lot of times, people build up quite a lot of aversions to these group sittings, these long sittings, actually. But a lot of the suffering you see is in the mind. Really, the reaction to it. In any case, going back to the Dhamma talk. No, so tonight, like I was saying earlier, Maga Puja was the event. There was a spontaneous meeting of 1,250 arhants came together where the Buddha was without having made any kind of arrangement. So that's when the Buddha gave his teaching on the Patimokkha. It's called the admonition that we chanted earlier. Basically, Buddhism in a nutshell. to refrain from evil, to do what's good, and to purify the mind. Right? But also it goes on. It's just kind of basic stuff, which a lot of traditional Buddhists would memorize. A lot of novices would memorize these the verses that we just chanted. And the other thing was I quite like is, yeah, this, you know, patient during Kanti is the highest ascetic practice. Now it's the Nibbana is the highest, what the Buddha said. And then it just expels out what the, you know, kind of the basic foundation of a monk's life or a nun's life, not harming others, delighting in seclusion, and yeah, and not making trouble. A samana is someone who is easy to look after, who is, you know, living in harmony wherever he or she is. And then we train by the Patimokkha, which are the rules laid down by the Buddha. And yeah, and not to eat too much, devote yourself to meditation. And that's pretty much it. You know, obviously, sometimes the Dhamma, the Sutta, what the Buddha teach, you know, you see on the shelf, there's like four big volumes. It can get very complicated, people think. You've got to learn all these different suttas, dependent origination, you got to study Pali, you got to know, you know, what all these different passages means. But not really. You know, and one of the things you hear me say over and over again is, you know, like Ajahn Dhan's practice. He said he only read a few paragraphs of what the Buddha said. And the rest of the time, he just kind of watched his mind. He just practiced meditation and just watched over his mind, developing wholesome states, developing peace and stillness, and developing just contemplating the body. So there are many doors to realize the Dhamma. But you don't need to know all, every single doors, every single path that leads to the mountain. You just need to know one path, one doorway, to release from suffering. And that's what I love about the Buddhist teaching. It can be very simple. And it can be brought, you know, it can be, and it's practical. It's something, you know, in the present moment. It's something that we all can apply, you know, according to our own inclinations or according to our own kind of strength and weaknesses. And because we are, you know, slightly different, each and every one, slightly unique, it just makes the path interesting to experiment with different practices, see how well it works for us, to see, you know, when is a good time to push a little bit against our comfort zone, when is a good time just to kind of float. And it takes a lot of wisdom, it takes a lot of kind of clarity to do this. It's not like a recipe where you just follow A, B, C, D, and then you're done. You're enlightened. You put in your 10 hours a day, 10 years, 20 years, ding dong, you get your certificate, you're enlightened now, you're stream entry. And then that's it. No, it's much more subtle, much more interesting. Not about kind of, you know, counting up the hours, how many breaths you've been. You got your 10 million breaths down under your belt, then you get to be a big teacher. Anything less than 10 million breaths, you're still a student. Or whatever it is that people have these ideas about what practice is. And that's one of the nice things is, you know, like I said, on Magga Pucha, reflecting on us, you know, like I said, would have been a great blessing in terms of my own practice of meeting all these kind of wonderful monks in Thailand. You know, getting to know, just being able to pay respect to Lumpur Lim, you know, Ajahn Dhan, and all the different spiritual kind of meditation masters, you know, that I was lucky enough to come across to be able to pay respect. And it's a, kind of like I said, it's a wonderful opportunity. And nothing else happened in my holy life, just to be able to bow to these great beings. I feel it's in itself a great blessing already, just to know them. There's so much in the world people, you know, pay respects, honor, revere things that are not leading towards peace, things that are not leading towards wisdom. You know, people kind of revere, esteem, respect, you know, powerful people, wealthy people, famous people, you know, and those people are far from, you know, kind and gentle, far from being wise, and just have the, you know, good karma to come into contact and to kind of realign my value system towards, you know, peaceful people, towards wise people. Yeah, it's been an amazing blessing. It's like, yeah, it is, you know. You talk to different people. You're meeting, like, you know, well-practiced monks or nuns. It's like winning the lottery, really, in terms of karmic. It helps just to align your practice, align your value system. And this helps, you know, yeah, okay, you might not be enlightened this lifetime, but at least it sets your compass in the right direction. That you know, whatever happens, you still remember, wow, met Nopo Lim. Just to pay respect, and just to see how what a wonderful monk he is. It's a great blessing. And something that I can always carry to all the way to, you know, to my deathbed. Something that, you know, it's hard to forget. You know, first time meeting all these kind of very well-practiced monks, meditation masters. Yeah, it's been a wonderful honor. And so, you know, as I practice, and I sit down, you know, you don't meditate for yourself. Meditate just to dedicate the merits to all these kind of wonderful beings. So, you know, like as you sit here, step seven, dedicating, you know, I am the one to be enlightened. I am going to put forth effort because I am a great meditator. I know I'm not going to move. I'm going to sit here. And it says, I'm sitting here out of faith and devotion to these teachers that they've trained, they've done it. You know, so can I a little bit. Oh, I'm sitting here just out of faith and devotion to Ajahn Chah, to his legacy that he left behind. Any goodness that I have, I dedicate them to my previous teacher, Ajahn Jai Saro, who was the abbot of the first monastery I was at, Pra Peter, who's no longer a monk, but he introduced me to Buddhism. So any goodness that I've kind of developed tonight, I dedicate those things to him, just to be there, the person who was the first monk I met, who just, you know, triggered something deep inside myself that I wasn't even aware of. And then I start, you know, to kind of, and the path of Buddhism starts to open up. And just you know, just meeting those people along the way, just to help, like I said, you know, open doors, help me to realign my value system, realign my views towards the Dhamma. And it's been a wonderful gift. So any merit, any goodness that I made, yeah, you kind of share those to those people. And also I can bring to mind all the people that's helped you in your life, in your practice, in different ways. So whatever goodness that you develop tonight, you know, it's good to bring those people up into your mind. And it's like, and to radiate, you know, all the goodness to them. You can also bring up all the people that's helped maintain this monastery. Built the sala, the first abbot, the different committee members, built volunteers who came in the past, coming to support us, support this center, and also the present, the beautiful volunteers who come, beautiful, give us wonderful food. I mean, we don't have to do anything. And they come and they give us beautiful food. And like I said, it's great. It's, you know, sometimes I feel bad for the Thai husbands of these Thai ladies, the husbands of these Thai ladies. They sometimes kind of a bit tongue-in-cheek, but they do, they complain. It's like, you know, the only time I get good food is when I go to the monastery. She never cooks like this for me at home. Usually cold sandwiches or frozen stuff. And then she makes all these beautiful curries. She brings it to the monastery. It's not fair. And in a sense, it's true. And that's why I think, in a sense, the practice is really easy. Because when you're eating the food, this is my personal theory, when you're eating the food, you're just not eating the physical nourishment. Like, you know, it can be very fatty, it could be meat, and it could be stuff. But you're also eating the love and the affection they put into food. There's so much faith and goodness that they cook. When they cook for the Sangha, cook it for the monk, they put a lot of goodness into that. And we're also eating that. So then when you eat so much goodness, then it's very easy for the mind to be still or calm. Where sometimes you go to these five-star restaurants or whatever, and people are under stress, and they're really afraid, and they're worried, and they're anxious. They're putting that in their organic food as well. And you're also consuming that. And, you know, and that's not so wholesome. So when I go down the line, I take the food. Yeah, it's not so much whatever it is, you know, fish or vegetable and or organic or wholesome or not wholesome. No, it's all, like Noble Samadhi said, it's all organic, all wholesome food. Because it came from wholesome intention. It came from really the purity of their heart. That they come, they buy the food, they cook and they drive, you know, 3 hours to offer to us. Yeah, so it's a beautiful act of dana. So it's all good food. Whatever it is, whether it's, you know, vegan, organic, or not, that's not the point. And so as we practice, hopefully throughout the day, not just, you know, on a special day like today, but every day, hopefully you are bringing up lots of kindness, lots of gratitude for the people who kind of come and help to maintain this monastery. And also bring up some kindness and gentleness with each other. We're all, you know, apart from the external appearances, man, woman, monks, lay people, we're all beings. We're all marching in the same direction. We're sitting here helping each other, sometimes in an external, obvious way, sometimes just in a more quiet, internal ways. That we're developing, you know, a momentum, helping to draw each other, helping to support each other in a kind of, you know, non-obvious ways towards release from suffering, towards nibbana, towards the highest happiness. And that, like I said, you know, from perspective, we're each individual looking after our own practice, looking after our own mind, of course. But from a different perspective, we're just part of a major, beautiful machinery, a beautiful kind of system that are just drawn people towards nibbana, towards release from suffering, towards the happiness, towards peace and harmony, towards love and acceptance. And it's beautiful to reflect that. It's not, yeah, okay, you know, I'm just part of this kind of thing. And then that's what a lot of times you're going to believe is non-self. We all have individual issues, but it's just not much. It's just issues. They come and then go. You find that day in and day out, every day, we're drawn toward making another step, another inch towards liberation. And it's a beautiful path, the Buddha said. We chant in the morning. Beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. So there's no need to rush towards the end. No need to get it over with. Because, you know, it's a beautiful experience each and every day. Yes, we have our irritation, we have our moments of disappointment, of anxiety and worries. But generally there is still kind of the deeper Dhamma that's propelling us, moving us towards a certain direction. And so after a while you just kind of, it's like you're in the a river, you're kind of floating along. You're not swimming so much anymore. You're just floating along the current. The current rushes, pulls you towards the ocean, towards all the way down to Nibbana naturally. Some people are swimming really quickly, trying to get there at the end. Other people are just kind of floating along. But it doesn't matter. You all get there at the end. As long as you don't get out of the river, as long as you maintain the practice, as long as you continue it, whatever ways you can. And I can remember just kind of reflecting what the Buddha said over and over again. I was reading in the Sangyutta, the chapter about, you know, the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's surprising how many different areas, different kind of places that the Buddha mentioned, you know, the precondition for the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path is good friendship, good companionship. Yeah. And then that's like, you know, yeah, like I said, it's like just, you know, being around good people, just help nurture that. So it's not so much about what you do, how much effort you put into, or how kind of focused you are. But it's just being around good people, being in the monastery or meditation center, or being associated with a group, just kind of helps to support and nurture all these wonderful qualities in us that you don't have to kind of worry about. You know, can be with a group of people that who you can trust. They're going to steal things from you. not gonna, you know, try to hurt you and harm you in any way. And the mind just can naturally become more still. Not gonna, you know, kind of distract each other with different gossips or worldly news or whatever. You just kinda, and the mind just naturally comes to a quiet place, nothing to stir us up, nothing to get worried over about. Mind just naturally settles down. And when you, and when the mind settles down, you can see clearly, easily. You don't get so distracted, you don't get so consumed by the stuff that you normally would be worried about in the outside world, at home or at work or whatever, the politics of the office, politics or whatever, or the different personality conflicts and frictions at home or at work or whatever. Here generally we have our differences, but generally we have enough space that allows us to kind of settle in, to look after their own mind. So like on this day of Magga Puja, just kind of hopefully when you've done some reading or have met some different monks and nuns or have come across different teachers, and just kind of bring them up in your mind. Bring up the wholesome qualities, not as the personality so-and-so, but yeah, the different wholesome qualities that these teachers embody. And certainly, you know, the best teacher that I can think of is obviously, yeah, you know, the Buddha. You know, just you see different monks, how wonderful they are, but you can, you know, when you think of the Buddha, you can multiply that by 1,000 times. This person is just so peaceful, so kind, so gentle, so wise. And those are the qualities that, you know, to focus on, not as a personality, but as an embodiment of the different qualities, the different, you know, kind of good qualities, wholesome qualities that we all have, the seed of Buddha natures, each and every one of us. So as I say over and over again, whatever you focus on, whatever you turn your mind to, so those are things that grow naturally. So we look towards the Buddha in terms of, you know, person who is full of compassion, full of wisdom, and these other, these the seeds of compassion, wisdom start to also grow and take root in our own heart. And then, and that, as that starts to grow, then it starts to overwhelm the other unwholesome qualities in our own heart and mind. Naturally, we don't have to try to get rid of them, but as goodness grow, you know, the other stuff, the unwholesome, starts to be overwhelmed. Yeah, it's what we focus on. So the more we focus on, yeah, the beauty, the harmony, the compassion, the forgiveness, the acceptance, the unconditional love of the Buddha, and, you know, then you can feel that, you can partake in all those qualities. And over time, those things start to kind of blossom in our own mind, and they become stronger and stronger day by day. Yeah, but the opposite is also true. You focus on the weed, the negativity, and you also get consumed, carried away by those things. Yeah? So when anything is, you know, just always leaning, always kind of massaging, managing towards wholesome qualities. And that's the thing. I think my path to Buddhism wasn't through books. I certainly deluded. I didn't see too much suffering in life. Well, that wasn't too bad. And I wasn't spiritual seeking. I was never. I was like, well, you know, yeah, I know that, you know, it's shallow. Achievement, happiness of the world is shallow, but nobody seems to have shallow. Yeah, meaningless, doesn't have anything. But everybody's doing this. Who am I to do anything? So I'll get a job, try to get ahead, get my promotion, make my money, try to get a family going, the usual stuff. We're all going to die anyway. So I was like, well, yeah. I was a materialist at then, so I didn't believe in an afterlife, even though I grew up a Catholic. Like, well, I don't believe in this kind of afterlife. But then this kind of running around, doing this, whatever else is doing, it doesn't seem to be that great, but everybody's doing it, so I guess I'm going to do the same thing. Yes, I wasn't really seeking for answers. Having done a philosophy degree, was kind of realized that there was not, there's no really answers anyway. And, you know, why are we here? Who knows? You know, why not? So yeah, so in that way it was more materialistic. But I did believe, and it was my kind of Catholic upbringing, was I did believe in kindness and gentleness. Even though there's nothing, kindness is still good to do, you know, to do others. So it's more of, you know, kind of the Christian belief, you know, do unto others as you do to yourself, or something like that, you know, at least. Yeah. And so there's always, you know, to be fair, to be kind if the opportunity arises, certainly. But it wasn't very looking for anything beyond that. And that's the thing. And when I met with the first monk, Prabhu Peter, was when he started teaching like the law of karma. That I was very interested, because I didn't believe in a God who sit there and took note and, you know this is, you're going to go to heaven because you believe in me, go to hell because you're a bad person, whatever. I didn't believe in that. But I thought, well, the law, that's kind of cool. The law of karma, that you do good, you get it back. If you do bad, you still have to pay for it. And it applies to everybody and everything. Because sometimes, you know, we all, you know, as a Christian background, we all want to pray. And I was like, well, why should he listen to me? Well, there's other four, you know, another 2 billion people also praying. Why do you know, why, how does God pick which one to give things to and which one to ignore? And there's people with cancer, and there's kids, you know, little kids suffering. Why, you know, why doesn't he cure them? And of course, you know, you would say, you know, traditional Buddhist, well, you know, he obviously operates in mysterious ways. You don't know. But sometimes believing in the law of karma, knowing, yeah, okay, you know, these things happen. And we all have to kind of be part, you know, be subject to the law of gravity. So I kind of, I don't know, it's kind of, and maybe I was a Buddhist in my past life or something, or a monk, so I kind of connected in a more of an emotional way. I didn't really think about it. But also I remember going to the monastery, you know, I told people many times that the morning chanting, I would get up and the chanting Pali, I didn't understand a thing, but I really liked it. Something felt like familiar when I was, the first time I went to a monastery, just to spend time with my friend, actually. It wasn't Buddhist, wasn't interested in the monastic life at that time, but it was kind of something very curious. And then I went to Wapananachat to train for a year, just a little meditation, see what that feels like. Even then, I wasn't sold. I was like, yeah, it's kind of interesting. And it's more of an experiment. I didn't really think anybody could live completely celibate and without money. It's like, no, they must be doing something funny. Maybe I'll write a book about this when I leave. A tell-all book, an expose. But no, I was really surprised. They're really, yeah, not perfect, but really pure-hearted, good intention, that trying to live the holy life as best as they could. Well, obviously, there are, you know, frictions in their personality, clashes or whatever, but they're really trying. And they're not hiding, they're not doing anything funny. They don't have jacuzzis in their kuti, they're not meeting people behind in the dark or anything. They're not gambling, drinking, running, doing silly things at night when people aren't looking. So I was at least impressed that much. But I wasn't wholly impressed to go, well, I don't want to do this for that long. It's only when I really met the meditation masters, the Ajahn Thanh, Lumpa Lim, Lumpur Thuy, and I just felt, wow, there was something here that I thought made me very curious. There's something very special, unworldly. There was like just simple people. They're not the most charismatic, just gentle, very quiet, very peaceful. But there's a very center where, you know, working stockbroker, you meet the mover and the shakers, you know, the wealthy, the important people, the politician. And yeah, okay, they had achievement, had things, they were very powerful, and they were very wealthy, but they didn't have that centerness. There's still plenty of suffering. There are lots of anxiety. They're full of egotistical things, and they're always full of worries as well. Want to, you know, be on top, always afraid that someone will kick them up. So in the worldly way, yeah, they're full of anxieties and worries, no matter where you are. You think, oh, well, you know, when they get up to a certain height, they must be so happy and relaxed. No, they're still full of worries and paranoia that someone will take things from them, someone will dethrone them. You know, the president, you know, even presidents, right, had to worry about elections and, you know, being kicked out the next 4 years or whatever, or worry about a coup or whatever, different things. But these kind of simple monks who don't have much, wow, they're really, really seems pretty center. And they're full of compassion. You can really feel it. When they talk to you, it's like talking to your favorite uncle, or just full of love and acceptance, that you don't have to worry about hiding anything. That he will just accept you the way you are. You don't have to be anything, do anything special. And I thought, wow, that was really, made me really curious. And that was one of the main thing that made me, encourage me to extend my year in the monastery. Otherwise, I would more than happy to go back to the States and continue on the life in finance and the worldly life. But meeting these people made me a lot more curious. And I said, oh, okay, maybe I'll do it for 5 years and see what happens. Yeah. So it's like I said, those things you can't really plan for. And different people affect in different ways. Some people see the same people and like, yeah, okay, yeah, he's a nice monk, but they didn't get that so much faith coming up or so much inspiration. And those are very kind of personal things, obviously. You can't force it. You see, either you feel it or you don't feel it. And it's fine. You don't feel it, you don't feel it. Yeah. But for myself, yeah, like I said, you know, a large portion of my monastic life is just out of faith and out of gratitude for just kind of meeting these monks. And just kind of hanging around being a monk and just meeting them again and paying respect to them. That's just so worth it. Yes, the meditation came together, became really peaceful, and different things, you know, kind of arise as part of the fruit of the practice. But it's just, yeah. It's still the highlight for myself anyway. Yeah, it's just being able to interact with these monks, being able to pay respect to them once a year, once every couple of years, and knowing that somewhere in the world there's still these beautiful, purified, wholesome beings that are practicing, and the fact that I'm wearing the same robes, doing the same thing. It's a wonderful kind of feeling. And that's why, you know, like tonight, you know, we're in Australia, thousands of miles away. But we know, well, myself and I haven't been in Thailand. I know for sure that in Thailand, everybody's doing the same thing. So we're part of this, like I said, we're part of the same infrastructure, Buddhist practicing on this full moon night. You know, everybody's sitting in meditation, doing a bit chanting. And it's beautiful to be part of something so beautiful, so wholesome, so low-key. We're not demonstrating, we're not back in a big party, we're not banging gongs or anything, we're just sitting quietly. But yeah, it's something much more powerful that we're sharing, that we're connected to through the Dhamma, than anything else that we could do in the worldly sense. And as you sit here, try to kind of point your mind towards that. You're just part of a sangha, of practitioners, not, you know, just from here, not on Australia, all the way to Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and not just in the present age, but all stretching all the way back to the past, to the Buddha, stretching all the way towards the future. Just another, instead of being, you know, thinking, you know, we're just part of a big, impersonal, meaningless thing. It's just the opposite. We're just part of a huge, massive thing that is meaningful, that's bringing peace and harmony to ourselves and others in the whole world, whether they know it or not, appreciate it or not, doesn't really matter. But it's a wholesome force of energy that just radiates outward to the universe. And it's just from each and every one of us sitting here, calming the mind, being still, just watching. Yeah, and it's great, kind of a beautiful feeling. And it gets beyond your personality, beyond your different issues that you're facing. beyond the problems that you're meditating or you're napping or you're nodding or whatever, or you're not feeling so happy, not feeling so appreciated, not feeling so respected, feeling stressed out, alienated, lonely, depressed. It's beyond all that. There's beauty, there's peace, there's love in a pure way. Love without personality, love without preferences. Love is a beautiful thing in each and every one of us. So, I think I'm rambling long enough. It's kind of, yeah, like I said, on this day of Magga Puja, one of the, you know, kind of the three most holy days of the Buddhist calendar, just offer you some reflections on the Sangha and how we can use that skillfully to bring up a bit of inspiration, a bit of energy, a bit of gratitude for the different teachers you met, and a bit of, you know, kind of camaraderie, that we're all part of this thing, no matter what we're doing, where we come from, where our destination is. Yeah, so I offer that for your reflection tonight.
Andamayam ovada dhamma kataya sadhu karam dadamasi sadhu 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 anumodam.
So we'll pay respects together, and then you don't have to leave, you can just be back there, but we need to do a bit of confession, a bit of kind of monk ceremony we have to do every fortnight, full moon, new moon. And then after that, you can sit and walk, depending on your preference, or as late as you feel is appropriate. But the only thing is, ask the people to come back at 5, and we all kind of do morning chanting together. Yeah, so if you are, we want to take a break during the night, so we try to come back by 5, and then we'll going to do morning chanting, and then pay respect. So that's, so tomorrow is there's not really morning meeting, just the chanting at 5 o'clock, and then people can go rest. Yeah, so that is the agenda. Half an hour maximum. Yeah. Yeah, I can call you. You're around here. I can call you in. Yeah. Otherwise, you can sit in the back. As long as you're out of arm's length, it's not a big deal. Yeah. So either or, you can sit back there or sit down there. Yeah, if there's a lot of mosquito, unless you're doing walking meditation, just sit back there. Yeah.
Pano bhagavato sāvaka sangho sangham namah.
You can take one out. You can take one. Throw it out. You're one of the duties we're supposed to do on these days. No, one of the monk's duties.